Welcome to Just JKing, the podcast where we transform your HR headaches into high fives. Whether you're a founder, CEO, or just someone with HR questions you're too afraid to ask, we've got the insights, laughs, and light bulb moments that you crave.
Enjoying the show? Hit that five-star review and subscribe now so you never miss out.
Welcome back to Just JKing.
Today, we're excited to welcome Dave Wan. Dave is a TEDx speaker, certified money coach, and the founder and CEO of Dave Wan & Co.
From conferences and summits to the corporate workplace, Dave has been empowering sales teams to transform their money mindset and turn their money blocks into confident, value-driven conversations that unlock higher value deals and deeper client relationships.
He's a former Air Force captain with a decorated military career and has been featured by TEDx, ABC, EBN, Sway Live, Military Media, and the Air Force.
Welcome to our podcast, Dave.
I am so excited to be here with you, Jennifer and Kim, and can't wait to dive into the conversation.
Yeah, and I, you know, from speaking to me over LinkedIn the last couple of years, I love this topic. I will fully admit I have struggled with financial triggers in building my own business. I think a lot of entrepreneurs do, especially in HR, because we don't really come from a financial background per se. It's very unfamiliar to us to even have to deal with that. So let's start at the beginning. What is a financial or a money trigger, and why have they been overlooked in sales teams? And we know they have, because Kim and I have supported lots of sales teams and this has never come up.
Oh, and we've become our own sales team in the last couple of years as well. So we're taking notes, Dave.
Yeah.
A financial trigger is like something that you feel inside, anxiety. It's an emotional trigger, mostly. You feel anxious, you feel stressed, you feel happy, you feel sad, whatever the emotional trigger might be that might lead to a certain type of behavior, right? So something happens, you're not really unsure of it, but you feel weird or good or whatever inside, and that leads to some sort of behavior on the outside, right? And that's what most people see. And so you have to be able to understand that it's not just, oh, I need this, and so I buy it. It's what's the emotional need? And the common saying when it comes to the buyer side of things is buyers buy with emotion, then justify it with logic, right? So you have to understand that there's an emotional trigger or an emotional driver or an emotional root that leads to a certain behavior on the outside.
And so, Dave, how do sales teams leverage that? Like, how does one take advantage of that knowledge?
So on the seller side, when you're a salesperson and you're selling to people, you have to understand that people are buying with their emotions, but they justify it with logic. So when they have an objection that seems logical, like I can't afford this, or it doesn't fit in our solution, there might be some truth to it, but the real reason behind why that happens is an emotional problem, right? And part of why people may not buy from you is because they may not trust you. Your tonality and body language may not have come across as I trust this person, and therefore I trust whatever service or product that they're selling, so therefore I'm going to buy it, right? If they don't trust you and they feel weird about it, regardless of whether the product or service fits or not, or is good or not for them, they could walk away from it. But it's also really important to know that it's not just buyers that buy with emotion, then justify it with logic. It's sellers sell with their emotions, then justify it with logic when things don't work out.
So tell us about that part. Tell us about the other half. I think this is the part I'm most interested in, because I do think it's largely ignored in terms of sales training. Even when there's a formal program, like at really large organizations, they don't cover this part. So tell us about the seller aspects of how their own, because they're human beings too, you know, they have all the same issues, and we understand they're motivated by money. And I think, you know, maybe they're drivers, and that kind of glosses over some other things that might be happening behind the scenes. And that's why we kind of just don't think about this part. But tell us what you know about the financial triggers and how they affect the sellers.
I'm going to answer that question by telling you a quick story.
Okay.
So I used to be a seller for a cybersecurity company back in the day. And the company was like just jacking up their prices like crazy. And when prices skyrocket like that, it really messes with sellers like myself. And I had more closed lost opportunities that year than I would have liked. And it was really easy for me to blame those closed lost opportunities on the price increases. I just didn't have a good year because of that, of this price increases, right? It's another hurdle for sellers to overcome. But it wasn't the price increases that caused this, it was me. I let my own definition of expensive be the client's definition of expensive. I let my own scarcity around money be the client's scarcity of money around money. And so even though I never said this, I screamed, "Kim and Jennifer, oh my gosh, I wouldn't buy this, would you?" And so that really impacted my, that really showed in my body language, my energy, my tone, my choice of words. And that led to a decreased amount of focus on them, attention on them, care on them, the amount of energy I should have had on them. That led to decreased trust, that resulted in decreased trust. And as a result, they didn't buy from me. And so it's a holistic approach. Buyers are human beings. Sellers are also human beings. Sellers are not robots. You can't just like give them all this training and say, you do steps 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and here's how it's going to work. Here's how you should prospect. Here's how you should handle objections. Here's how you should follow up. Here's how you should have like be on this campaign. And you could have a slick sales process, and that's all very, very important. I'm not discounting any of that. But the underpinning driver and the foundation behind all that is the human being. And the human being also has emotions. And you also have to know that they're bringing their own baggage or head trash around money with them to that conversation. Just like I did in the story I just shared with you, I let my own definition of expensive be the client's definition of expensive. So as a result, I'm like, oh, I wouldn't buy this, would you? And so the conversation wasn't about them, it was unintentionally about me.
I know, and I see that all the time. I have a very, I have like a, I hate the word expensive. It's a relative term. There's no
Soup
such thing
all the
as
time.
expensive.
All the
Like
time.
expensive for who? For me or for, you know, Prince William? Like, and what you have to be making assumptions in you in order to even use that word because it's relative. So you're assuming something about me that you think lines up with where you think expensive falls, and it actually drives me nuts. And I really push back on that. And I sometimes, like as a seller, they'll say it's expensive, and I obviously can't jump down their throat and correct them about the fact that that's like a relative term. But I always think to myself, what you mean is you can't afford it, so that I don't then adapt their paranoia, like so I don't get paranoid that my thing is expensive because it's actually not necessarily expensive. It's expensive to them, and I don't want to get thrown off by their so I don't know what you think about my little trick to try to get that term out of my head.
I'm so guilty of using that word too. And I use it all the time. But being on this journey, whenever people say expensive, immediately my head goes, for who? And what does that even mean? And when people say they can't afford things, I don't even know what that means either now. They're, like it's so nuanced, and it's like you're using a term, and then you're like using that term as a blanket statement. And it's just like there's deeper meaning behind it, underneath it. And you have to be able to understand what that is.
And so, Dave, talk to me a little bit about, you know, for a million years, we've been hearing about value-based selling. And now we're talking about kind of money triggers and money blocks. How do you leverage, or is value-based selling still something that sales teams should be relying on, in your opinion? What do you think? Like, is it an, are there new trends? Is this something they still need to kind of look at and think through these concepts? Like, tell us how it all fits together.
No, value-based selling is absolutely important. Like if you don't sell based on the value that you're bringing to the client, and by the way, selling is not manipulation. Selling is not, I'm going to force you to buy something from me. Selling is serving. Selling is solving a problem. I'm here to help to really understand everything about you. Do a deep dive discovery. And even the, I believe it's the salesperson's job to find a pain point that you never even know existed. So, for example, My mom passed away in 2022, but in 2021, I visited her for the first time in a couple years. And when I went home, I looked at her face and I'm like, my heart just sank. Something just felt wrong. So the next day, we ended up going to the hospital or the clinic in the local town. And she, she was complaining about like some pain in her abdomen. And I was just hoping it'd be really small, like, and you could take some medicine and you're done, right? So initially I'm thinking, okay, like we're gonna take care of this. It's not gonna be a big deal. And we'll do the copay and I don't know, $50, let's say out the window. But when the nurse came in and did some examination, she ended up directing us to the ER. We went to the ER, they did some scans, they did some testing, and turns out this stomach pain was not just normal stomach pain after a bad meal. This was cancer. And a 10-centimeter tumor in her liver.
Oh my.
And now what I thought was the pain was not the pain. There was another pain that the doctor discovered. And now my budget went from, okay, we're gonna spend $50 on this, copay, all these things. I don't know how it works in Canada, but like, yes, in here. And then all of a sudden I'm like, okay, like take my entire bank account. Let's work on this because I need to save my mom's life.
Right.
Right. And so when you discover something that the client didn't even know existed, they're going to see, and you show them, like, here's the pain point and here's how we could help you. Like, there's so much value discovered in that conversation. And where I come in is, are some of your feelings and beliefs about money, are you unknowingly injecting it into the conversation and preventing yourself from doing that deep discovery? And you're making the conversation all about you. If the doctor didn't do that deep discovery, we wouldn't have found that out, right? But he made the conversation and the relationship all about us and figured out what was really going on instead of making it all about him.
So, how does a salesperson become aware of these? I'm going to call them biases almost in the way that they approach a conversation. How do you check yourself?
Yeah, so the program that I have, you first have to be aware and you have to acknowledge some of the patterns and habits that you have with these money-driven sales behaviors that these salespeople have. So I have a diagnostic that people go through, and the diagnostic reveals some of these like patterns and habits that they have with money. And a lot of these patterns, one thing I say is, whenever money is on the line, which is every sales opportunity, so many of your sales behaviors ties back to money because money is on the line every time. And so some of these examples might be discounting before the client even asks for it.
Oh gosh, yeah.
Av avo avoiding discussing like premium solutions. I remember I did that. Or you might even hesitate to go after like the million-dollar opportunities because you're like, there's no way I'm going to get that. Maybe over justifying your pricing. Hey, our stuff is $50,000. Take it or leave it. Like, hey, like we're going to, this is what we do. We're going to provide you value. We've already done the full deep dive discovery, and both parties know like what's at stake here. But hey, Kim, it's $50,000. I know it's a lot of money. It's a lot of money for who? So if I'm over justifying, like, why am I doing that? Feeling anxious during money conversations, making assumptions about what clients can or can't afford. Here's a good one. Rushing through the sales process because maybe you're thinking, I need to close this by the end of the quarter. If I close by the end of the quarter, I make this much money. If I make this much money, I could do XYZ, pay off debt, pay for a car, whatever it might be. Right? It's all about me. Right? Instead of like taking the time to really understand what's going on. You have to be aware of what's going on. And so I have a big process, a deep process where it gives salespeople the opportunity to really understand their money patterns and behaviors, because a lot of that is happening subconsciously.
There's a ton of them. That's, and I've.
I have way more symptoms that I could list off, but like I just listed off a few. But these are like common money driven sales behaviors. Like they're all driven by money because, like I said, whenever money is on the line, which is every sales opportunity, people can act weird.
So, Dave, I'm going to ask a question, and maybe it's a little bit controversial, but are you finding that some of these symptoms are more prevalent with women than they are with men? Because we as women professionals often talk about, having a very hard time assigning value to the work that we do, particularly when we go out into professional practice. And I'm sure that that is not only for HR people who have continually had to justify their existence at the table for many years. I do know that other women who are in sales have similar experiences. They are received at the table in a different way than men are. And what are you seeing in your practice, and how are you advising either same or differently to women?
I have seen both men and women experience both positive and negative behaviors on both sides. And so much of our behaviors are primarily rooted in our upbringing, right? A lot of the patterns that we have as adults, like those roots are from our upbringing. There was a study done by the University of Cambridge, by Cambridge University. Back in 2013, that showed that our core money habits and patterns were formed by the age of 7 years old.
Oh my goodness.
So a lot of the stuff that we do now as adults are rooted back in the first 7 years of our life.
Connect that for me. Like, what happens in your life where at seven you, I mean, I believe it because I have my own personal story where I can recognize that. But that's
So
shocking.
yeah, I'll answer your question, but let me answer Kim's question
Sure.
first. So when it comes to men and women, just from my experience, I've seen both. Okay, so I haven't collected more data on my end to go, okay, men do this, women do that. Naturally, just from my experience over the last 8.5 years of working with people, I've experienced both. And I've seen men be way more like indecisive and emotional when it comes to money, and I've seen some women not be right. And so, like, instead of like going men are this and women are that, I just dive into their stories individually,
Right.
and then they're able to work through those things, right? To answer your question, Jennifer, I don't remember a single conversation about retirement, investments, saving. Here's how you should set up a budget and spend at the grocery store at the dinner table in the first 7 years of my life. I don't remember a single conversation like that. And even if there was, it's irrelevant. So for me, my understanding is that the patterns and habits that you have as adults, as an adult, when it comes to money, is all rooted from the first 7 years of your life. And the drivers are all emotional. And so one of the first, a common question that people ask me is, I have some kids. What are some things I could do with my kids to teach them about money? And my answer to that is teach them how to regulate their emotions and teach them how to problem solve. Because imagine, so I have three kids right now under 5 years old. And I'm not the perfect parent, but if I know
Nobody
it's
with
got
three kids under 5 years old is a perfect parent, Dave. The
But
fact
like
that you're here today
imagine,
is a miracle.
but every day alive is a miracle. But like imagine, like there are times when my oldest daughter, 4.5 years old, she can't figure something out. I'm like, gosh, just like drop this thing and figure it out, or like drop it and move on. I could say that, or I could say, okay, let's slow down. Let's walk through this. Okay, what are some things going on here? Breathe. Okay, what are some logical steps you could take? What's the problem? And like, what are you trying to do? And what are you trying to solve? Correlate that with adults that completely spend like crazy. People know that they shouldn't spend more than what they make, but people break that all the time. Why is that happening? Because their limbic brain, their rational brain is not taken over, their irrational brain taken over, the emotional side's taken over, and they're just reacting, not responding to the situation. Right. So your ability to problem solve and regulate your emotions as a child will carry over into adulthood. And if you can't regulate that as adulthood, how you spend your money will follow suit. How you try to address that will be shown in how you spend your money or how you save your money, right? And so it's all the emotional regulation that is needing to happen as a child that will impact those behaviors and patterns as adults.
I think what's interesting with that too is you can have two kids that grow up in the same household at the same dinner table and they have the opposite reaction to those experiences. And I've seen it in my own extended family. It's like one is like completely out of control and the other one literally had their mortgage paid off in 10 years, you know, like just extreme. But they're obviously both adapting just in a different way to some kind of unhealthy dynamic around money because you don't have to be the opposite and not spend any either. You know, it just seems to really show up different for everybody.
You know, I'm not an expert in this, but there's like attachment theories. You've heard of that. I don't know if you've heard of that, but attachment theories are important.
As we talk about kind of the family dynamic and the relationship with money, I want to take us back to the relationship with money within a company. And so, can you help us understand how companies can create the healthier culture around money conversations?
Think it's really important to for leaders to openly discuss money, not just numbers wise, but emotions. But the only way leaders are going to be able to do that is if they have a healthy relationship with money.
Oh,
And a
start
lot
there.
of
Also, I mean, it also suggests a level of transparency in yeah.
the
what is
the
going on in the financials. And I have a number of clients where I'm talking to them about compensation quite a bit. And, you know, talking about bonus programs or the development of bonus programs is one of the things that I do a lot of. And the biggest conversation with these clients is, and of course, bonus programs are all linked to organizational results. They're very transparent. But they don't want to talk about EBITDA. They don't want employees to have access to a certain level of knowledge that is really intimate to them when it comes to money and financial health of the organization. So tell us more.
I think when it comes to money, there's a numbers aspect to it. There's a math aspect to it, but there's a strong emotional aspect to it that most people don't understand. And that's part of my mission in this life to like help people understand that side. Now, when it comes to leaders in companies, I think it's really important for them to explain their decision making that impacts the business as a whole, that impacts the company as a whole. I'm sure you've seen plenty of examples of leaders make decisions and you're like, why did that doesn't make any sense, right? I'm going to go back to my earlier statement. Buyers buy with emotion, then justify it with logic. Okay. I'm going to reframe that to sellers sell with emotion, then justify it with logic. Okay. I'm going to reframe that again. And then I'm going to say decision makers make decisions based on emotion, but justify it with logic. So decision makers can also go, well, we're doing this to save costs and like have all these logical reasons, but the reason behind it might be scarcity, their fear of the company going down if they don't cut costs right away. They just had to make a very reactive move. Maybe they're doing some things in the background to prove somebody wrong.
Right.
Or
Well, more
maybe
often what they're doing is they're trying to justify and tell a story to either their investors or to their board of directors that they're being fiscally responsible. But we both know, Jennifer and I have actually had multiple conversations. When you riff, you're often not realizing the benefit of that savings for another year to 18 months because now you've paid all kinds of severances. And by then, the market has rebounded, financial situation looks better, and now you've hired back half of that sales force, if not all of them.
but the reason behind why people do what they do, like maybe the company is like, we're not going to invest in technology, and all the salespeople are going to do certain things manually to like do some outbound sales. It's like if we had this technology that costs $200,000, you're actually going to save like, I don't know, 90% of the time like that you would have spent anyways, right? And so like it's just going to expedite the process more. You're going to save a lot more money. You're going to make a lot more money. But some companies might refuse to upgrade their technology as a result of it. And you have to understand why that decision is being made. And even though they're saying to the company, Here are the logical reasons why that's happening. The reason might be all emotional, and the only person that knows that true emotion is going to be the person that makes the decision. So it's for decision makers and leaders to actually understand their own emotions when it comes to money, because without that, they're going to be unknowingly making the decision. I'm going to go back to the sales term that I said earlier. They're going to make the decision unknowingly about them and not the company and the people that they're serving.
So it sounds like you definitely would be best served by starting at the top, because if there's layers in the organization that aren't able to manage their triggers effectively, then that's going to kind of make it difficult for any other part to down further down the hierarchy to do it as well, because it's going to get a little bit kind of mucked up when somebody who doesn't recognize what's happening gets there in the middle and kind of doesn't sort of get it, get what the what's happening or understand how their emotions are impacting their decisions.
And if some people are not being paid what they are worth, and they fought for it year over year over year, and they've proven themselves year over year over year, and they're still not getting paid what they're worth or what the market is valuing them at. You know, people have talked about corporate greed and things like that. I think it's really important to understand why that greed is happening in the first place, and why those leaders are doing that. And they could say some things like, they could say logical things, but what I'm saying is, like, it's important to understand the emotional drivers. That's going to be better for the company and better for the people that they're serving, and the workforce that actually helped the company get to where it is, right?
I think
So.
it's safe to say that there are a lot of leaders who have gone surprisingly far without recognizing those blind spots.
I think it's really important to understand those blind spots, because if you want to be the people's leader, it's important to be aware of those blind spots. Without that, you're unknowingly going to make every decision about you, and you may not even be aware of it.
So, Steve, we've had a lot of conversations about where some of these blockages come from. I mean, and aside from having our salespeople go to therapy and really unlock and uncover where their perceptions first began before they were 7 years old, how would a sales leader help to coach their team and assess and help them move through whatever it is that's holding them back? Where should they start?
Yeah, so that's when they bring in people like me,
There you go.
right? I wasn't gonna pitch myself, but sales leaders are not trained in this, and so I have a program called Step Zero. And Step Zero, the reason why I called it Step Zero is because a sales cycle is what? Steps one through
Oh, yeah.
close,
Okay.
If you look at the Salesforce website, their typical like sales cycle is steps one through seven, but what the training and the conversation is missing is the relationship with money that each salespeople are bringing to the conversation. And so that's why I called it Step Zero, because this is what is the foundation of everything, right? And so once you do that, so once you are aware of what's going on, you have to be able to identify some of these patterns in your story. The behaviors that you have now as salespeople, which is tied to money, are patterns that have been forming over time. And you have to be able to understand the root of that. And so my framework for identifying themes and patterns is flow. F stands for feelings. Okay. So what are some of the emotional patterns that you see over time? L is link. Link also stands for relationship. What are some of the relational patterns? Like, oh, whenever something happens, oh, my mom's over here. Or my sister or my dad, like whatever the figure is, like it's going to be showing up, right? O stands for output. So behavior patterns, like the underlying recurring thing. Oh, I keep avoiding this, or I keep controlling this, or I keep, whenever this happens, I tend to save more. Whenever this happens, I tend to spend more, whatever that might be. Like track some of the behaviors that have evolved over time. And the last one is worldview. The belief patterns. So identify some of the conclusions that you drew about money over time. Rich people are snobs. No, they're not. But that's what I've been thinking the whole time. Oh my gosh. Or money is scarce. I know that's a big problem for a lot of people, right? People think there's never enough, but there's plenty. So you have to understand like what those are. So it's really important to dive into your story. Once you dive into your story, you're going to be able to gain perspective, gain awareness, hopefully some empathy and compassion on some of the things that have happened, and be able to rewrite your story and set yourself on a new trajectory.
I love that. So, Dave, you've shared so much goodness with us today. We do a section of the show where we ask our guests a number of questions. And so the first one is the big question, and then we're going to go into rapid fire. Are you ready?
I'm ready. Let's
All
go.
right, Jennifer, take it away.
Okay. Kim and I work with small businesses. That's primarily our audience. So, what's the one thing you believe a small business could do today to change the game for their people?
Small businesses and the owners, I'm going to repeat myself, but they have to understand their emotional relationship with money. And I believe if they're open about it, they could gain a lot of trust with their workforce. So I think it's really important to understand their decision making is based, like a lot of the drivers behind it is based off of like emotional roots tied to money. And so I think it's really important to be open about that. And if you're open about that, I think it's just really, I think you can get the trust for from your folks.
Yeah. All right, let's do rapid fire. Kim, take it
All
away.
right. Okay, great. So, Dave, what was your first job?
My first job. I worked at a like an after school tutoring program. I worked at a place called Kumon, and I was hired by them to be a private tutor for I don't know how old he was, like a 7-year-old.
Oh.
I was 12 years old, and they're like, "Oh, you're good at math, so like, can you tutor a 7-year-old with math?" So I was like making up tests and stuff like that. That was my first job.
Wow.
I was making like 5.25 or 5.75 an hour. My first paycheck was $40. It was awesome.
Excellent. And what was your best job?
I'm gonna name two. So, ending my time in the Air Force, I taught at the Air Force Academy, which is in Colorado, and I spent 3 years teaching there, and I taught marketing there, and I taught a bunch of juniors and seniors about to be second lieutenants in the Air Force. And it was just so much fun just being in the classroom with them, interacting with them, sharing life advice and whatnot. So that was a really memorable time. If I could do that for the entire if I for my entire life, I would. I really love that job. The other job that I really enjoyed was when I was a senior in high school. I was a traffic director at a parking lot for a private valet company, like a valet company. And the place where I lived is South Orange County, California. Like I saw Kobe Bryant there. I saw a bunch of celebrities there. I had celebrities come up to me wanting to park their car where I was at. So I just ran into a lot of celebrities down there, like Exhibit. You guys know Exhibit? Exhibit is he had a TV show on MTV called Pit My Ride. So he would take an old
Oh,
beat up car.
yes.
He would take an old beat up car and like spice it up and turn it into something cool, right? He was there. He gave me like $20, but I just saw all these random people there. So it was as a senior in high school, worked there for a little bit. So that was a lot of fun.
Tell us about your biggest mess up at work.
I was the perfect employee. No, I'm just
Of
kidding.
course you were, Dave.
I was waiting for him to say it's classified.
Your best learning.
My best learning, honestly, as an entrepreneur and business owner, I always have to ask myself what's working, what's not working, and why, always. And I think during my time in the military, I never really asked myself that question. You're just given some tasks and you just kind of follow along like a robot and you just do it. My time in corporate America, not the same as my time in the military. I learned a ton there, but as my, just running this business and running this business now, like what's working, what's not working, and why, and what are the steps I need to take to get to where I need to be. But the biggest thing, like now that I think about it, the biggest thing I learned is storytelling.
That's a good one. That's a good one.
And honestly, LinkedIn has helped a ton. So
Yeah.
when I first started writing on LinkedIn 2.5 years ago, I was trying to figure this out. And as time went on, I got better and better and better. I have definitely more room for growth, but like I got better and better and better. And now I use the same strategy whenever I do keynotes or like whenever I'm on podcasts like this. Like some of the stories that I shared before, like earlier in the podcast, like get a hook, get to the punch. What's important? What's relevant? What's the pain point? What's the solution? And like, what's the path forward? How do I make that really concise and digestible for the reader and the listener in under like 45 seconds, right? In under 30 seconds. And so that's what I try to do. And I think it's really, really important to do that. And so whenever you're talking to people at a networking event or trying to pitch yourself for a business, as a business, like it's really important to be able to storytell. So I think that's like the biggest learning that I've had to date.
And here's Jennifer's favorite question. What is your quickest quit?
I don't like to admit this, but past relationships before my wife.
That counts.
My quickest quit was probably like, oh, there was one that probably was an hour.
Oh my goodness.
And like I met her.
Not a relationship, Dave. That's a date.
I know that is a very quick, I didn't even give it time. Like it was at a mini golf and I'm like, oh, that was a terrible decision. There, you can't even leave at that point. You have to go through the whole course, right? So I'm like, this is miserable. Like within like 5 seconds, I knew like this is not it.
That's so funny. I think I actually have you beat on that one, but I don't dare tell the story. But yeah.
Oh, I've got a good one too. Yeah. So, advice today for sales leaders and for single people everywhere from Dave Wong. Dave, where can our audience find you if they're interested in working with you to help energize and support their sales teams?
Yep. So if you are part of like if you're a sales leader, chief revenue officer, VP of sales, director, and you're in B2B sales, I don't replace sales training, I augment sales training. And so I can be reached at Dave Wan, DaveWon dot co dot co. And
Excellent.
my LinkedIn is Dave Wan, and you can find me there as well.
Thank you so much, Dave. This was really, really informative and definitely fun way to spend our morning.
Well, it was really like thank you so much for having me here today. And I just really enjoyed the conversation. So thank you for that.
And that's a wrap on today's episode of Just JKing. We hope you enjoyed the conversation and took away some valuable insights to shake up your own HR game.
If you loved this episode, and we hope you did, make sure to hit that subscribe button, leave us a review, and share it with your network. We want to hear your thoughts, your feedback, and even your own wild HR stories.
And don't forget to connect with us on LinkedIn or drop us a message. Let us know what topics you want us to dive into next.
Until next time, keep it real, keep it human, and always keep JKing.
We'll see you next time on Just JKing. Thanks for listening.